Chapter 45. Blanky. Latitude, unknown. Longitude, unknown. 18 June, 1848. When Tom Blanky's third and final leg snapped off, he knew it meant the end. His first new leg had been wondrous to behold. Shaped and whittled by Mr. Honey, Terra's capable carpenter, it had been carved out of a single piece of solid English oak. It was a work of art, and Blanky enjoyed showing it off. The ice master had peg-legged his way around the ship like a good-humoured pirate, but when Blanky had to go out onto the ice, he attached to the bottom of the peg a perfectly shaped wooden foot that snapped into a socket. The foot had a myriad of nails and screws on the bottom, better for traction on the ice than the hobnails in the men's winter boots, and the one-legged man, while not able to man-haul, had been more than able to keep up during their transfer to Terra Camp from the abandoned ship, and then in the long haul south and now east. No longer. His first leg had broken off just below the knee 19 days after they'd abandoned Terra Camp, not long after they'd buried poor Pilkington and Harry Le Vicomte. That day, Tom Blanky and Mr. Honey, who'd been excused from man-hauling, both had ridden in a pinnace, strapped to a sledge, pulled by 20 straining other men, while the carpenter carved a new leg and foot for the ice master from wood taken from a spare spar. Blanky had never been sure whether or not to wear his foot when hobbling along with the procession of boats and sweating, swearing men. When they actually ventured out onto the sea ice, as they had the first days crossing the frozen inlet south of Terra Camp, and again at Seal Bay, and once more at the broad bay just north of the point where they'd buried Le Vicomte, the screwed and cleated foot worked wonders on the ice. But most of their march south, and then west along and around the large cape, and now back east again, was made on land. As the snow and ice on the rocks began to melt, and it was melting quickly this summer that was so much warmer than their lost summer of 1847, Tom Blanky's wooden ovoid of a foot would slide off slick rocks or be pulled off in ice crevices or would snap at the socket with every inopportune twist. When out on the ice, Blanky tried to show his solidarity with his mates by hiking back and forth with the man-haulers, making both trips alongside the straining, sweating men, carrying small items when he could, occasionally volunteering to slip into the harness of an exhausted man. But everyone knew he could not pull his own weight with the hauling. By the sixth week, and 47 miles out, at Comfort Cove, where poor Captain FitzJames had died so hard, Blanky was on his third leg, a poorer, weaker substitute than the second one had been, and he tried manfully to hobble along on his peg, through the rocks, streams, and standing water, although he no longer went back for the afternoon's hated second haul. Tom Blanky realized that he had become just so much more dead weight for the exhausted and ill survivors, 95 of them now, not including Blanky, to haul south with them. What kept Blanky going, even when his third leg began to splinter, there were no more extra spars from which to whittle a fourth, was his rising hope that his skills as an ice master would be needed when they took to the boats. But while the scrim of ice on the rocks and barren coastline melted during the day, sometimes the temperature rose as high as 40 degrees, according to Lieutenant Little, the pack ice beyond the coastal bergs showed no sign of breaking up. Blanky tried to be patient. He knew better than any other man on the expedition that sea ice at these latitudes might not show open leads, even on a more normal summer such as this one, until mid-July or later. Still, it was not only his usefulness that was being decided by the ice, but his survival. If they took to the boats soon, he might live. He did not need his leg to travel by boat. Crozier had long since designated Thomas Blanky as skipper of his own pinnace, commanding 8 men, and once the ice master was at sea again, he would survive. With any luck at all, they could sail their fleet of 10 little splintered and gouged boats right to the mouth of Back's Great Fish River, pause at the mouth to re-rig for river running, and, with only the slightest help from northwest winds and men at the oars, head briskly upstream. The portages, Blanky knew, would be hard, especially hard for him, since he could carry so little weight on his flimsy third peg, but a piece of cake after the man-hauling nightmare of the last 8 weeks. If he could last until they took to the boats, Thomas Blanky would live. But Blanky knew a secret that made even his sanguine personality wane. The thing on the ice, the terror itself, was after him. It had been sighted every day or two as the straining procession of men had rounded the large cape and turned back east again along the shoreline. Every day, in the early afternoon, when they turned back to haul the 5 boats they'd left behind, every twilight, at around 11 p.m, as they collapsed into their wet Holland tents for a few hours' sleep. The thing was still stalking them. Sometimes the officers saw it through their telescopes as they looked out to sea. Neither Crozier, nor Little, nor Hodgson, nor any of the other few officers remaining ever told the man-hauling men that they'd seen the beast, but Blanky, who had more time than most to watch and think, saw them conferring and knew. At other times, those hauling the last boats could see the beast clearly with their own unaided eyes. Sometimes it was behind them, trailing by a mile or less, a black speck against white ice, or a white speck against black rock.
"It's just one of them polar white bears," had said James Reed, the red-bearded ice master from Erebus, and one of Blanky's closest friends now. "They'll eat you if they can, but mostly they're harmless enough. Bullets kill them. Let's hope it comes closer. We need some fresh meat."
But Blanky knew at the time that it wasn't one of the white bears they shot for food from time to time. This was it. And while all men on the long march feared it, especially at night, or rather during the 2 hours of dimness that now passed for night, only Thomas Blanky knew that it was coming for him first. The march had taken a toll on everyone, but Blanky was in constant agony. Not from scurvy, which seemed to be affecting him less than most, but from the pain in the stump of the leg that the thing had taken. Walking on the ice and rock of the shore was so difficult for him that by mid-morning of each day's 16- or 18-hour march, his stump would be streaming blood down over the wooden cup and leather harness that held it in place. The blood soaked through his thick canvas trousers and ran down his wooden peg, leaving a trail of blood behind. It soaked upward through his long underwear, trousers, and shirt. During the first weeks of the march, while it was still cold, it was a blessing that the blood had frozen. But now, with the tropical warmth of days above zero, some above freezing, Blanky was bleeding like a stuck pig. The long slops and greatcoats also had been a blessing. They hid the worst evidence of Blanky's bleeding from the captain and others, but by mid-June, it was too warm to wear the greatcoats while hauling, so tons of sweat-soaked slops and wool layers were piled in the boats they were hauling. The men often hauled in shirt sleeves through the warmest parts of the day, pulling on more layers as the afternoons cooled towards 0 degrees. Blanky had joked with them when they asked him why he continued to wear his long coats.
"I'm cold-blooded, boys," he'd said with a laugh. "My wooden leg brings the chill of the ground up into me. I don't want you to see me shiver."
But eventually, he had to take off the greatcoat. Because Blanky was working so hard hobbling just to keep up, and because the pain of his tortured stump caused him to sweat even when he was standing still, he could no longer stand the freeze and thaw of all his layers of clothes. When the men saw the blood pouring, they said nothing. They had their own problems. Most of them were bleeding from scurvy. Crozier and Little often would pull Blanky and James Reed aside, asking the two ice masters their professional opinion about the ice just beyond the berg barrier of the shoreline. Once they'd come around to the east again, along the southern coast of this cape that had bulged out miles to the west and south of Comfort Cove, probably adding 20 miles to their haul south, Reed was of the opinion that the ice between this part of King William Land and the mainland, whether King William Land was connected to the mainland or not, would be slower breaking up than the pack ice to the northwest, where conditions were more dynamic come the summer thaw. Blanky was more optimistic. He pointed out that the bergs piled here along this southern coast were becoming smaller and smaller. Once a serious barrier, separating the shore from the sea ice, this wall of bergs was no more a hindrance now than a cluster of low seracs. The reason, Blanky told Crozier, and Reed had agreed, was that this Cape of King William Land was sheltering this stretch of sea and coast, or perhaps of gulf and coast, from the glacier-like river of ice that had poured down so relentlessly from the northwest onto Erebus and Terror, and even upon the coast near Terror Camp. That endless press of ice, Blanky pointed out, had been flowing down from the North Pole itself. Things were more sheltered here south of the King William Land southwestern cape. Perhaps the ice would break up sooner here. Reed had looked at him strangely when Blanky delivered that opinion. Blanky knew what the other ice master was thinking. Whether this is a gulf or a strait leading to Chantry Inlet and the mouth of Back's River, ice usually breaks up last in a confined space. Reed would have been correct if he'd stated that opinion aloud to Captain Crozier. He hadn't, obviously not wanting to contradict his friend and fellow ice master, but Blanky was still optimistic. In truth, Thomas Blanky had been optimistic in his heart and soul every day since that dark night of 5 December of the previous winter, when he'd considered himself a dead man as the thing on the ice chased him from Terror and into the forest of Serax. Twice the creature had tried to kill him, and twice all that Thomas Blanky had lost had been parts of one leg. He hobbled on, bringing cheer and jokes and the occasional shred of extra tobacco or sliver of frozen beef to exhausted, drained men. His tent mates, he knew, valued his presence. He took his turn at watch in the ever-shorter nights and carried a shotgun while painfully stumping alongside the morning boat procession as a guard, although Thomas Blanky knew better than any living man that no mere shotgun would stop the terror beast when it finally came in close to claim its next victims. The tortures of the long march were increasing. Not only were men slowly dying of starvation and scurvy and exposure, but there had been 2 other incidences of the terrible poisoning death that had claimed Captain Fitzjames. John Cowie, the stoker, who had survived the Thing's invasion of Erebus on 9 March, died screaming in cramps and pain, and then silent paralysis on 10 June. On 12 June, Daniel Arthur, Erebus's 38-year-old quartermaster, collapsed with abdominal pains and died from paralyzed lungs a mere 8 hours later. Their bodies were not truly buried. The procession had paused only long enough to sew both bodies into the little remaining spare canvas and to pile rocks on them. Richard Aylmore, the object of much speculation since Captain Fitzjames's death, showed almost no signs of illness. The scuttlebutt was that while everyone else had been banned from eating warm meals from the canned foods and suffered the scurvy worse for it, Aylmore had been ordered to share portions of his tinned meals with Cowie and Arthur. Other than the obvious answer of active and deliberate poisoning, no one could figure why the Goldner tins would horribly kill 3 men but leave Aylmore untouched. But while everyone knew that Aylmore hated Captain Fitzjames and Captain Crozier, no one could see a reason for the gunroom steward to poison his mates, unless he wanted their shares of food after they were dead. Henry Lloyd, Dr. Goodsir's assistant in the sick bay, was one of the men dragged along in the boats these days, sick from scurvy that had him vomiting blood and his own loose teeth. So since Blanky was one of the few men other than Diggle and Wall who stayed with the boats after the morning haul, he tried to help the good doctor. Oddly enough, now that it was getting tropically warm, there were more cases of frostbite. Sweating men who'd doffed their jackets and gloves would continue man-hauling into the chill of the endless evening. The sun hung in the south until midnight now, and be surprised to find that the air temperature had fallen to 15 below during their exertions. Good Sir was constantly treating fingers and patches of skin turned white by frostbite, or dead black from rot. Sun blindness or screaming headaches caused by the sun's glare afflicted half the men. Crozier and Goodsir would move up and down the ranks of man-hauling men during the morning, cajoling them to put on their goggles, but the men hated the wire mesh monstrosities. Joe Andrews, captain of the hold for Erebus and an old friend of Tom Blanky's, said that wearing the goddamned wire goggles was as difficult as trying to see through a pair of ladies' black silk drawers, but much less fun. The snow blindness and headaches were becoming serious problems on the march. Some of the men begged Dr. Goodsir for laudanum after the headaches struck, but the surgeon told them that he had none left. Blanky, who was often sent to fetch medicines from the doctor's locked chest, knew that good sir was lying. There was a small vial of laudanum left there, unmarked. The ice master knew that the surgeon was keeping it for some terrible occasion, to ease Captain Crozier's last hours, or the surgeon's own. Other men suffered the torments of hell from sunburn. Everyone was blistered red on their hands and faces and necks, but some men who would tug off their shirts for even the shortest periods during the intolerable heat of the midday, when temperatures were above freezing, would that same evening watch their skins bleached white after 3 years of darkness and enclosure burn red and quickly turn to suppurating blisters. Dr. Goodsir popped the blisters with his lancet and treated the open sores with a salve that smelled to Blanky like axle grease. By the time the 95 survivors were trudging east along the southern coast of the Cape in mid-June, almost every man was on the edge of breakdown. As long as some men could manhaul the terrible heavy sledges with boats atop them and the full-packed whaleboats without sledges, others suffering could ride briefly, recover slightly, and rejoin the manhauling within hours or days. But when there were too many sick and injured to pull, Blanky knew their escape march would be at an end. As it was now, the men were always so thirsty that every stream or trickle of water was a reason to stop and throw themselves on all fours to lap at the water like dogs. If it hadn't been for the sudden thaw, Blanky knew, they would have all died of thirst 3 weeks earlier. The spirit stoves were almost out of fuel. At first, melting snow in one's mouth seemed to assuage the thirst, but it actually drained more energy from the body and made one thirstier. Each time they dragged the boats and themselves across a stream, and there were more streams and rivulets running liquid now, everyone would stop to fill water bottles that no longer needed to be carried next to the skin to keep them from freezing. But while thirst would not kill them soon, Blanky saw that the men were failing in 100 other ways. Starvation was taking its toll. Hunger kept the exhausted men from sleeping through the 4 hours of twilight if they did not have watch duty, which Crozier allowed for their sleeping time. Setting up and taking down the Holland tents, simple acts that had been performed in 20 minutes 2 months ago at Terror Camp, now took 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the evening. Each day it took a little longer as fingers became more swollen and frostbitten and clumsy. Few of the men's minds, not even Blanky's at times, were really clear. Crozier seemed the most alert of all of them most of the time, but sometimes when he thought that no one was looking, the captain's face became a death mask of fatigue and stupor. Sailors who had tied off complicated rigging and shroud knots in the roaring darkness 50 feet out on a pitching spar 200 feet above the deck on a stormy night off the Strait of Magellan during a hurricane blow could no longer tie their shoes in the daylight. Because there was no wood within 300 miles, other than Blanky's leg and the boats and masts and sledges they'd hauled along with them, and the remains of Erebus and Terror almost 100 miles to their north, and because the ground was still hard frozen an inch below the surface, the men had to gather heaps of stones at each stop to weigh down the edges of the tents and to anchor tent ropes against the inevitable nightly winds. This chore also took forever. Men frequently fell asleep standing in the dimmed sunlight at midnight, with a rock in each hand. Sometimes their mate did not even shake them awake. So it came to pass that late in the afternoon of the 18th day of June 1848, as the men were making their second haul of boats that day, when Blanky's third leg snapped off just below his bleeding knee stump, he took it as a sign. Dr. Goodsir had little work for him that afternoon, so Blanky had turned back to peg his way alongside the last boats on the second haul of the endless day, when the foot and peg had caught between two immovable rocks and snapped the peg off high. He took the high break and his unusual presence near the end of the march as a sign from the gods as well. He found a nearby boulder, made himself as comfortable as he could, dug out his pipe, and tapped in the last bit of tobacco he had been saving for weeks. When a few of the seamen stopped in their hauling to ask what he was doing, Blanky said,
"Just going to sit a spell, I reckon. Give my stump a rest."
When Sergeant Tozer, who was in charge of the Marine Rear Guard detail this sunny day, stopped to ask tiredly what Blanky was doing, allowing the procession to pass him by, Blanky said,
"Never you mind, Solomon.
He had always enjoyed irritating the stupid sergeant by using his first name.
You just toddle off now with your remaining lobster backs and let me be.
Half an hour later, when the last boats were hundreds of yards to the south of him, Captain Crozier had come back with Mr. Honey the carpenter.
What the hell do you think you're doing, Mr. Blanky?
Snapped Crozier.
Just giving it a rest, Captain. I thought I might spend the night here.
Don't be an ass, said Crozier.
He looked at the snapped-off peg leg and turned to the carpenter.
Can you fix this, Mr. Honey? Make a new one by tomorrow afternoon, if Mr. Blanky rides in one of the boats until then.
Oh, aye, sir,
said Honey, squinting at the broken peg with an artisan's scowl at the failure, or mistreatment, of one of his creations.
We ain't got much spare wood left, but there's one extra jolly boat rudder we brought along as a spare for the pinnaces that I can turn into a new leg, as easy as you like.
Do you hear that, Blanky? Asked Crozier. Now get off your arse and let Mr. Honey help you hobble to catch up to Mr. Hodgson's last boat there. Quickly now. We'll have you fixed up by tomorrow noon.
Blanky smiled.
Can Mr. Honey fix this, Captain?
He tugged off the wooden cup of the leg and detached the clumsy leather and brass harness.
Oh, Christ, damn it,
said Crozier. He started to look more closely at the bleeding, raw stump with the black flesh surrounding the white nub of bone, but quickly pulled back his face from the smell.
Aye, sir, said Blanky. I'm surprised Dr. Goodsir ain't sniffed it out before this. I try to stay downwind of him when I'm helping him out in the sick bay. The boys in my tent know what's up, sir. There's nothing to be done for it.
Nonsense, said Crozier.
Goodsir will...
He stopped. Blanky smiled. It was not a sarcastic or sad smile, but an easy one, filled with some real humour.
Will what, Captain? Take my leg off at the hip? The black bits and red lines run all the way up to my arse and private parts, sir, with apologies for being so picturesque about it. And if he did operate, how many days would I be lying in the boat like old Private Heather, God rest the poor bugger's soul, being hauled along by men who are as tired as I am?
Crozier said nothing.
No,
continued Blanky, puffing contentedly on his pipe.
I think it'd be best if I rested here a while on my own and just relaxed and thought some thoughts about this and that. My life has been a good one. I'd like to think about it some before the pain and stink get so bad I'm distracted.
Crozier sighed, looked at his carpenter, and then at his ice master and sighed again. He took a water bottle from the pocket of his greatcoat.
Take this.
Thank you, sir, I will. With gratitude, said Blanky.
Crozier felt in his other pockets.
I have no food with me, Mr. Honey.
The carpenter came up with a mouldy biscuit and a sliver of something more green than tan that might have been beef.
No, thank you, John, said Blanky. I am truthfully not hungry. But, Captain, would you do me a huge favour?
What is that, Mr. Blanky?
My people are in Kent, sir. Near Item Moat, north of Tunbridge Wells. Or at least my Betty and Michael and old Mum were when I set sail, sir. I was wondering, Captain. I mean, if you have luck on your side and have the time later.
If I get back to England, I swear I'll look them up and tell them that you were smoking and smiling and sitting as comfortably on a boulder as a lazy squire when last I saw you, said Crozier.
He pulled a pistol from his pocket.
Lieutenant Little's seen the thing through his glass. It's been trailing behind us all morning, Thomas. It'll be along presently. You should take this.
No, thank you, Captain.
You're sure about this, Mr. Blanky? Staying behind, I mean,
said Captain Crozier.
Even if you were with us for just another week or so, your knowledge of the ice might be very important to us all. Who knows what the conditions will be out on the pack ice 20 miles east of here?
Blanky smiled.
If Mr. Reed weren't still with you, I'd take that to heart, Captain. I surely would. But he's as good an ice master as you could ask for. As a spare, I mean.
Crozier and Honey shook hands with him. Then they turned and hurried to catch up to the last boat, disappearing over a distant ridge to the south. It was after midnight when it came. Blanky had been out of tobacco for hours,
and the water had frozen in the bottle where he'd foolishly left it sitting on the boulder next to him. He was in some pain, but he did not want to sleep. A few stars had come out in the twilight. The wind from the northwest had come up, as it usually did in the evening, and the temperature had probably dropped 40 degrees from its noontime high. Blanky had kept the broken peg leg and its cup and straps on the boulder next to him. While his gangrenous leg tormented him and his empty stomach clawed at him, the worst pain tonight was from his lower leg and calf and foot, his phantom limb. Suddenly, the thing was just there. It loomed up on the ice, not 30 paces from him.
It must have come up through some invisible hole in the ice, Blanky thought.
He was reminded of a tent fair in Tunbridge Wells he had seen as a boy, with a rickety wooden stage and a magician in purple silk with a tall conical hat embroidered with crude planets and stars. That man had appeared just like this, popping up through a trap door to the oohs and ahs of the country audience.
Welcome back, said Thomas Blanky to the shadowy silhouette on the ice.
The thing reared up on its hind legs, a dark mass of hair and muscle and sunset-tinted claws, and a faint gleam of teeth beyond anything, the Ice Master was sure, in mankind's racial memory of its many predators. Blanky guessed that it was more than 12 feet tall, perhaps 14. Its eyes, a deeper blackness against the black silhouette, did not reflect the dying sun.
You're late, said Blanky.
He could not help it that his teeth were chattering.
I've been expecting you for a long time.
He threw his peg leg and its rattling harness at the shape. The thing did not try to dodge the crude missile. The shape towered there for a minute and then rushed forward like a wraith, the legs not even visibly moving to propel it, a monstrous mass sliding rapidly toward him across the rock and ice, the dark and terrible solidity of the shape finally opening arms to fill the Ice Master's vision. Thomas Blanky grinned fiercely and clamped his teeth down hard on the stem of his cold pipe. Chapter 46. Crozier. Latitude unknown. Longitude unknown. 4 July 1848. The only thing keeping Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier moving forward into the 10th week on the boat march was the blue flame in his chest. The more tired and empty and sick and battered his body became, the hotter and fiercer the flame burned. He knew it was not merely some metaphor of his determination, nor was it optimism as such. The blue flame in his chest had burrowed toward his heart like some alien entity, lingered like a disease, and centered in him as an almost unwanted core of conviction that he would do whatever he had to do to survive. Anything. Sometimes, Crozier came close to praying that the blue flame would just go out, so he could surrender to the inevitable and lie down and pull the frozen tundra up over himself like a child under a blanket, settling into his nap. Today they were stopped, not pulling the sledges and boats for the first time in a month, and they had unpacked and clumsily pitched the large sick bay tent, although not the large mess tents. The men were calling this otherwise unremarkable place on a small bay along the southern coast of King William Land, Hospital Camp. In the past 2 weeks, they had just crossed the rugged ice of a huge bay that cut into the underside of the cape that seemed for weeks of hauling as if it would continue to bulge out to the southwest forever. But now they were headed southeast again, paralleling the coastline along the underside of that cape, and then farther east, the correct direction, if they were to get to Back's River. Crozier had brought his sextant and theodolite along, and Lieutenant Little also had his sextant, as well as the dead Fitzjames's instrument as a spare, but neither officer had taken star sightings or sun sightings for weeks. It just wasn't important. If King William Land was a peninsula, as most of the Arctic explorers, including Crozier's old commander James Clark Ross, had thought, then this coastline would lead them to the mouth of Back's River. If it was an island, which had been Lieutenant Gore's guess, and Crozier's hunch as well, then they would soon see the mainland to their south and cross what should be a narrow strait to the mouth of Back's River. Either way, Crozier, who had been content to follow the coastline since they had no other real choice, and navigate by dead reckoning for the time being, estimated that they were now about 90 miles from the mouth of Back's River. On this march, they had been completing only a little better than a mile per day on average. Some days they did 3 or 4 miles, reminding Crozier of the fantastic rate of their crossing from the ships to Terra Camp on the ice highway they had laid down. But other days, when there was more rock than ice under the runners, when they had to ford sudden streams, or in one case an actual river, when they were forced out onto the tortured sea ice, when the coastline became too rocky, when the weather was foul, when more men than usual were too sick to pull and ended up riding in the boat themselves while their mates pulled the extra weight. First, the 16 hours of man-hauling the 4 whaleboats and a cutter, then back for the other 3 cutters and 2 pinnaces, saw them covering only a few hundred yards from their previous night's camp. On 1 July, after weeks of warming weather, the cold and snow returned in earnest. A blizzard blew out of the southeast, directly into the eyes of the men hauling their sledges. Slops were pulled out of baled heaps in the boats. Welsh wigs were dug out of valises and packs. The snow added hundreds of pounds to the weight of the sledges and the boats atop them. The men, so sick that they were being carried in those boats, lying atop supplies and folded tents, burrowed under the canvas covers for shelter. The men hauled forward through 3 days of continuous driving snow out of the east and southeast. At night, lightning crashed, and the men cowered low against the canvas floors of their tents. Today they had stopped because too many of the men were sick, and good sir wanted to administer to them, and because Crozier wanted to send parties ahead to scout, and larger armed parties north into the interior and south, out onto the sea ice to hunt. They needed food, badly. The good news and the bad news was that they had finally finished the last of the Goldner canned foods. When the steward Aylmore, who on captain's orders had continued to eat and grow fat on the tinned foods, hadn't died from the terrible symptoms that killed Captain Fitzjames, although 2 other men who were not supposed to be eating from the cans had, everyone went back on the tinned foods to supplement the little remaining salt pork and cod and biscuits. The 28-year-old seaman Bill Clausen died screaming silently and convulsing from gut pains and paralysis, but Dr. Goodsir had no clue what might have poisoned him until one of his mates, Tom McConvey, confessed that the dead man had stolen and eaten a Goldner can of peaches that no one else had shared. In the very brief burial service for Clausen, his body lying without even a canvas shroud under the loose pile of rocks because old Murray, the sailmaker, had died of scurvy and there was no extra canvas left anyway, Captain Crozier had quoted not from the Bible, the men knew, but from his fabled Book of Leviathan. "Life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short," the captain had intoned. "It seems it is shorter for those who steal from their mates." The eulogy, such as it was a hit with the men. Although the 10 boats they had been dragging and hauling on sledges for more than 2 months all had old names assigned to them from when Erebus and Terra still sailed the seas, the man-hauling teams of seamen immediately renamed the 3 cutters and 2 pinnaces, always hauled during the afternoon and evening stint of hauling, the part of the day they hated the most, since it meant regaining ground already won through the sweat of the long morning. The 5 boats were now officially named Solitary, Poor, Nasty, Brutish, and Short. Crozier had grinned at this. It meant the men were not so far gone into hunger and despair that their English sailor's black humour did not still hold a cutting edge. The mutiny, when it came, was made vocal by the last man on earth that Francis Crozier would have imagined opposing his command. It was the middle of the day, and the captain was trying to get a few minutes' sleep while most of the men were out of camp, doing reconnaissance or hunting. He heard the slow shuffle of many screw-heeled boots in the snow outside his tent, and he knew immediately that there was trouble outside the usual range of daily emergencies. The furtive sound of the footsteps as he came up from his light sleep warned him of the defiance to come. Crozier pulled on his greatcoat. He always carried a loaded pistol in the right pocket of this coat, but recently he had begun carrying a smaller 2-shot pistol in his left pocket as well. There were about 25 men assembled in the open area between Crozier's tent and the large sickbay tent.
The blowing snow, thick scarves, and filthy Welsh wigs made some of them hard to identify at first glance. But Crozier was not surprised to see Cornelius Hickey, Magnus Manson, Richard Aylmore, and a half dozen of the more vocal resenters in the second row. It was the first row facing him that surprised him. Most of the officers were off commanding the scattered hunting and scouting parties Crozier had sent out that morning. Crozier realized his mistake too late, sending away all of his most loyal officers, including Lieutenant Little and his second mate Robert Thomas, Tom Johnson, his faithful boatswain's mate Harry Pegler, and some others, all at once, leaving the weaker men congregated here at Hospital Camp. But standing in front of this group was young Lieutenant Hodgson. Crozier was also shocked to see Reuben Mail, captain of the forecastle, and Erebus's captain of the foretop, Robert Sinclair, here. Mail and Sinclair had always been good men. Crozier strode toward the gathering so quickly that Hodgson actually took two steps back and collided with the giant idiot Manson.
"What do you men want?"
rasped Crozier. Wishing that his voice was not such a hoarse croak, he put as much volume and authority into it as he could.
"What the hell is going on here?"
"We need to talk to you, Captain," said Hodgson.
The young man's voice was trembling with tension.
"About what?"
Crozier kept his right hand in his pocket. He saw Dr. Goodsir come to the opening of the sickbay tent and look out in surprise at the mob. Crozier counted 23 men in the group, and despite the wigs pulled low and scarves pulled high, he noted who each man was. He would not forget.
"About going back," said Hodgson.
The men behind him began muttering assent with the crowd murmur that was always the hive mind sound of mutineers. Crozier did not react at once. One piece of good news here was that if it was an active mutiny, if all the men including Hodgson and Mail and Sinclair had already agreed to take control of the expedition by force, Crozier would be dead by now. They would have acted in the twilight dimness at midnight. And the only other piece of good news was that while two or three of the seamen here were carrying shotguns, all the other weapons were out with the 66 men hunting today. Crozier made a mental note never to allow all of the Marines to leave the camp again at the same time. Tozer and the others had been eager to hunt. The captain had been so tired that he had not thought twice about giving them permission to go. The captain looked from face to face. Some of the weaker ones in the crowd looked down immediately, ashamed to meet his gaze. The stronger ones, like Mail and Sinclair, stared back. Hickey looked at him with eyes so hooded and cold they could have belonged to one of the white bears they'd encountered, or perhaps to the thing on the ice itself.
"Go back to where?" snapped Crozier.
"To Terra Camp," stuttered Hodgson. "There's canned food and some coal, and the stove's there. And the other boats we left."
"Don't be a fool," said Crozier. "We're at least 65 miles from Terror Camp. It would be October, solid winter, before you reached it, if you ever did."
Hodgson wilted, but the captain of Erebus's foretop said,
"We're a hell of a lot closer to the camp than we are to this river. We're killing ourselves to haul the boats too."
"That's not true, Mr. Sinclair," rasped Crozier.
"Lieutenant Little and I estimate that the inlet to the river is less than 50 miles from here." "The inlet," sneered a seaman named George Thompson.
The man was known for drunkenness and laziness. Crozier could not cast the first stone at him for the drinking, but he despised laziness.
"The mouth of Back's River is 50 miles south down the inlet," continued Thompson. "More than 100 miles from here."
"Watch your tone, Thompson," warned Crozier in a tone so low and deadly that even that lout blinked and looked down.
Crozier looked around the crowd again. He spoke to all the men.
"It doesn't matter if it's 40 miles down the inlet to the mouth of Back's River or 50 miles. Odds are good that it will be open water. We'll be sailing the boats, not dragging them. Now go back to your duties and forget this nonsense."
Some men shuffled, but Magnus Manson stood like a broad dam, holding the lake of their defiance in place. Reuben Mail said,
"We want to go back to the ship, Captain. We think we'll have a better chance there."
It was Crozier's turn to blink.
"Go back to Terror? Good Christ, Reuben. It must be more than 90 miles back to the ship.
across pack ice, as well as back through all that rough territory we've come through. The boats and sledges would never make it.
We'll just take one boat, said Hodgson.
The men murmured agreement behind him.
What the hell are you talking about? One boat?
One boat, insisted Hodgson. One boat on one sledge.
We're sick of this manhole in shite, said John Morfan,
a seaman who had been seriously injured during the carnival. Crozier ignored Morfan and said to Hodgson,
Lieutenant, how do you plan to get 23 men into one boat? Even if you steal one of the whale boats, that will only hold 10 or 12 of you, with minimal supplies. Or are you planning on having 10 or more of your party die before you get back to the camp? They will, you know, more than that.
There are small boats at Terra Camp,
said Sinclair, stepping closer and taking an aggressive stance.
We take one whale boat back and use it and the jolly boats and the ship's boats to ferry us out to Terra.
Crozier stared a moment and then actually laughed.
Do you think the ice is broken up there northwest of King William Land? Is that what you fools think?
We do, said Lieutenant Hodgson. There's food on the ship. Lots of the canned food left, and we could sail for...
Crozier laughed again.
You'd bet your lives that the ice has opened up enough this summer. The Terror is afloat and just waiting for you to row your dinghies out to her. And that leads have opened up the entire way we came south. 300 miles of open water. In winter, when you get there, if any of you do.
It's a better gamble than this, we think,
shouted the gunroom steward, Richard Aylmore. The dark little man's face was contorted with rage, fear, resentment, and something like exhilaration now that his hour had come round at last.
I'd almost like to go with you, began Crozier.
Hodgson blinked rapidly. Several of the men looked at one another.
Just to see your faces when that gamble pays off, with you walking across the ice and pressure ridges to find the Terror has been broken up by the ice, just as Erebus was in March.
He let the effect of that image sink in for a few seconds before he said softly,
For Christ's sake, ask Mr. Honey, or Mr. Wilson, or Mr. Goddard, or Lieutenant Little about what shape her knees were in. What shape her rudder was in. Ask First Mate Thomas about how badly her seams had started way back in April. It is July now, you fools. If the ice has melted around her, even a wee bit, odds are greater that the old ship has sunk than floated. And if she hasn't, can 23 of you honestly tell me that you can man the pumps while sailing her through the maze of leads? If you get back in half the time it took you to get here just from Terror Camp, the winter freeze will already be setting in again. And how are you going to find your way through the ice if the ship can float, if it hasn't sunk, if you don't die manning the pumps day and night?
Crozier looked around the mob again.
I don't see Mr. Reed here. He's out with Lieutenant Little, scouting our way south. With no ice master, you'll have a pretty time finding your way through the pancake ice and growlers and pack ice and bergs.
Crozier shook his head at the absurdity of it all and chuckled as if the men had come to tell him a particularly good joke rather than foment a mutiny.
Go back to your duties now, he snapped. I won't forget that you were foolish enough to bring this idea to me, but I'll try to forget the tone you used and the fact that you came like a mob of mutineers, rather than like loyal members of Her Majesty's Royal Navy wanting to talk to their captain. Go on with you now.
No,
said Cornelius Hickey from the second row, his voice high and sharp enough to stop the wavering men in their tracks.
Mr. Reed will come with us. So will the others.
Why will they? Asked Crozier, pinning the ferret with his gaze.
They won't have any choice,
said Hickey. He tugged at Magnus Manson's sleeve, and the two stepped forward, past an alarmed-looking Hodgson.
Crozier decided that he would shoot Hickey first. His hand was on the pistol in his pocket. He would not even remove the weapon from the greatcoat for the first shot. He would shoot Hickey in the belly when he got 3 feet closer, and then pull the pistol out and try to shoot the giant in the center of his forehead. No body shot was guaranteed to bring Manson down. As if his thinking about shooting had made it happen, there came the crack of a shot from the direction of the coastline. Everyone except Crozier and the caulker's mate turned to see what was happening. Crozier's gaze never left Hickey's eyes. Both men turned their heads only when the shouting started.
Open water!
It was Lieutenant Little's party coming in from the pack ice. Ice Master Reed, Bosun John Lane, Harry Pegler, and half a dozen others, all carrying shotguns or muskets.
Open water!
Screamed Little again. He was waving both arms as he came across the rocks and ice of the shoreline and was obviously unaware of the drama going on in front of his captain's tent.
Not more than 2 miles south. Leads opening up large enough for the boats. Going on to the east for miles. Open water!
Hickey and Manson stepped back into the ranks of cheering men where a mob had stood 30 seconds earlier. Some of the men started hugging one another. Reuben Mayle looked as if he was going to throw up at the thought of what he'd been about to do, and Robert Sinclair sat down on a low rock as if all the strength had gone out of his legs. The once powerful foretop captain began to weep into his filthy hands.
Get back to your tents and your duties, said Crozier. We'll start loading the boats and checking the masts and riggings within the hour.
Chapter 47. Pegler. Somewhere in the strait between King William Island and the Adelaide Peninsula. 9 July, 1848. The men waiting in hospital camp had been eager to depart 10 minutes after Lieutenant Little's party brought in the word of the open water, but it was another day before they broke camp, and another 2 days until the boat's hulls were actually slipped from the ice into the black water south of King William Land. First, they had to wait for all the other hunting and reconnaissance parties to return, and some came back after midnight, staggering into camp in the dim yellow Arctic twilight and collapsing into their sleeping bags without even hearing the good news. Very little game had been bagged, but Robert Thomas's group had killed an Arctic fox and several white rabbits, and Sergeant Tozer's team brought back a brace of ptarmigan. On the morning of 5 July, a Wednesday, the sick bay tent all but emptied out, as everyone who could stand or stagger wanted to lend a hand in preparations for putting to sea. John Bridgens had taken the place of the dead Henry Lloyd and Tom Blankey as Dr. Goodsir's assistant in recent weeks, and the steward had watched the previous afternoon's near mutiny while standing next to the surgeon in the door of the sick bay tent. It was Bridgens who described the whole scene to Harry Pegler, who felt sicker than he already was by learning that his Erebus foretop counterpart, Robert Sinclair, had joined in the near uprising. Reuben Mayle, he knew, had always been a dependable man, but strong-willed, very strong-willed. Pegler had nothing but contempt for Aylmore, Hickey, and their sycophants. In Harry Pegler's eyes, they were all men with busy little minds, and, except for Manson, an abundance of words, but no sense of loyalty. That Thursday, the 6th of July, found them out on pack ice for the first time in more than 2 months. Most of them had forgotten how terrible the man-hauling was on the open ice, even here in the lee of King William Land, and the bulbous cape they'd just come around. There were still pressure ridges to haul the 10 boats up and over. The sea ice was far less slippery under runners than the snow and shore ice were. There were no vales in which to shelter, no low ridge lines, not even the occasional boulder in which to hide from the wind. Out here there were no trickling streams to drink from. The snowstorm continued, and the wind grew stronger out of the southeast, blowing directly in their faces as they hauled the boat the 2 miles Lieutenant Little's hunting group had covered before coming across the open lead. The first night out they were so exhausted that they did not even erect the Holland tents, but pitched a few tent floors as tarps extending from the leeward side of the boats and boats on sledges and huddled together on the ice through the few hours of Arctic summer dimness in their 3-man sleeping bags. Even with the storm, wind, and pack ice difficulties, energized by their excitement, they covered the 2 miles by mid-morning, Friday, 7 July. The lead was gone, closed up. Little pointed out the thinner ice, none more than 3 to 8 inches thick where it had been. With Ice Master James Reed in the lead, they followed the zigzag path of the recently frozen over lead southeast, then due east for much of that day,
Now, added to their disappointment and ever-present misery, exacerbated by the snow in their faces and their thoroughly soaked clothing, came the tension, for the first time in years, of walking on thin ice. A little after noon that day, Marine Private James Daly, who was one of six men sent ahead to test the ice by poking at it with long pikes, fell through. His comrades pulled him out, but not before he quite literally turned blue. Dr. Goodsir had Daly stripped naked on the ice, wrapped in Hudson's Bay blankets, and bundled under more blankets beneath the canvas cover of one of the cutters. Two other men had to stay with him, lying on either side of him in the canvas yellow dimness beneath the boat cover so that their body warmth could keep him alive. Even then, Private Daly's body shook, and his teeth chattered uncontrollably, and he ventured into delirium for much of the rest of the day. The ice, as stable as a continent underfoot for 2 years, now rose and fell in low swells in a way that made everyone dizzy and caused some men to vomit. Pressure made even the thicker ice crack and groan with sudden explosions from far ahead, close ahead, to either side, behind, or directly underfoot. Dr. Goodsir had explained to them months before that one of the symptoms of advanced scurvy was a man's heightened sensitivity to sound. The blast of a gunshot could actually kill a man, he had said, and now the majority of the 89 men pulling the boats across the ice recognized those symptoms in themselves. Even a near idiot like Magnus Manson realized that if any or all of the boats fell through the ice, ice that had failed to support a single, skinny, starved scarecrow of a man like James Daly, there would be no hope for any of the men in harness. They would drown, even before they froze to death. Used to their tight procession across the ice, the men felt strange about their new man-hauling method of keeping the boats far apart and staggered. At times in the snowstorm, each group would be out of sight of all the other groups, and the sense of isolation was terrible. When they went back to haul the last three cutters and two pinnaces forward, they did not follow their old tracks and had to worry that the new ice they were on would not hold them. Some of the men grumbled that they might have already missed the inlet leading south to the mouth of Back's River. Pegler had seen the charts and Crozier's occasional theodolite reading and knew that they were still a good distance to the west, 30 miles to the inlet at the very least, another 60 or 65 miles south then to the mouth. At the rate of their travel on land, even if food appeared and everyone's health miraculously improved, they would not reach the inlet until August, and the mouth of the river until late September at the earliest. The promise of open water made Harry Pegler's heart pound. Of course, his heart was pounding erratically much of the time these days anyway. Harry's mother had always worried about his heart. As a boy, he had suffered scarlet fever and frequent pains in his chest, but he'd always told her such concerns were nonsense, that he was foretop captain in some of the world's greatest ships, and that no man with a bad heart could hold such a position. Somehow, he convinced her he was fine, but over the years, Pegler felt occasional flutters in his chest, followed by days of pain and a sense of constriction and an ache down his left arm so bad that some days he had to climb to the foretop and upper spars with only one hand. The other foretop men thought he was showing off. These last weeks, his heart fluttered more frequently than not. He'd lost the use of his left fingers 2 weeks ago, and the ache never left him. This, along with the embarrassment and inconvenience of the constant diarrhea, Pegler had always been a modest man, even about doing his business in the open over the side of a ship, which other men gave no thought to, had kept him constipated and waiting for darkness, or the seat of ease. But there was no seat of ease on this march, not even a goddamn bush or shrub or large rock to hide behind. The men in Pegler's hauling team laughed that their petty officer would fall behind out of sight and risk being taken by the terror rather than allow himself to be seen taking a shit. It wasn't the friendly laughter that had bothered Pegler in recent weeks. It was the rushing to catch up with his team and to get back into harness. He was so exhausted from the internal bleeding and lack of food and heart flutters that he was having more and more trouble rushing to catch the receding boats. So out of 89 men this Friday, Harry Pegler was probably the only one who welcomed the blowing snow and the fog that came in after the snow began to abate. The fog was a problem. Travelling so separately across the treacherous ice, it would have been easy for the boat teams to lose one another. Even backtracking to pick up the remaining cutters and pinnaces had been a problem, and that was before the fog grew thick as evening approached. Captain Crozier called a halt to discuss the matter. No more than 15 men were allowed to congregate on a small area of ice at one time, and that not too near a boat. They were pulling this evening with the fewest men it took to move the huge, heavy masses of boats and sledges. The sledges were going to be a logistical problem if they ever reached the promised open water. The chances were great that they would need to load the deep draft cutters and pinnaces with their keels and fixed rudders on sledges again before they reached the mouth of Back's River. So they couldn't just abandon the battered vehicles on the ice. Before leaving on Thursday, Crozier rehearsed taking the 6 sledged boats off, collapsing the heavy sledges as much as they had been designed to be collapsed or broken down, and stowing them properly in the boats. It took hours. Setting the boats back up on their sledges before going out onto the pack ice was just within the men's failing strength and abilities. Fingers stupid with fatigue and scurvy fumbled with simple knots. A shallow cut kept bleeding. The slightest jostle left hand-shaped bruises on their softening arms and in the thinning skin above their ribs. But now they knew they could do it. Unload, then load again the sledges, ready the boats for launching, if they found the lead soon. Crozier had each boat team light lanterns fore and aft. He called back the almost useless marine ice checkers with their pikes and appointed Lieutenant Hodgson as officer to lead the Diamond of 5 boats, with one of the heavy whale boats filled, with the least essential items being pulled ahead of the others in the fog. Every man there knew that this was young Hodgson's reward for throwing in with potential mutineers. His man-hauling team was led by Magnus Manson, while Aylmore and Hickey were also in harness, men who until now had been assigned to separate teams. If this lead boat team broke through the ice, the others would hear the screams and flailings through the heavy evening fog, but there would be nothing they could do except leave them and go a safer way. The rest now must risk a near procession, staying close enough that they could see the others' lanterns in the growing gloom. Around 8 p.m., there did come shouts and screams from Hodgson's lead team, but they had not fallen through. They'd found open water again, more than a mile east and south of where Little had seen a lead on Wednesday. The other teams sent men forward with lanterns, moving tentatively on what they assumed was thin ice, but the ice stayed firm and was estimated to be more than a foot thick right up to the edge of the inexplicable lead. The cleft of black water was only about 30 feet wide, but it extended off into the fog. "Lieutenant Hodgson," commanded Crozier, "make room in your whaleboat for 6 men at oars. Put the extra supplies out on the ice for now. Lieutenant Little will then take command of the whaleboat. Mr. Reed, you will go along with Lieutenant Little. You will proceed down the lead for 2 hours, if that is possible. Don't raise your sail, Lieutenant, oars only, but have the men put their backs into it. At the end of 2 hours, if you get that far, turn around and row back with your recommendation as to whether it's worth our effort to launch the boats. We'll use the 4 hours you're gone to unload everything here and pack the sledges into the remaining boats."
"Aye, sir," said Little, and began barking orders.
Pegler thought that young Hodgson looked as if he might weep. He knew how hard it must be to be in your 20s and know that your naval career was over. "Serves him right," thought Pegler. He'd spent decades in a navy that hanged men for mutiny and lashed them for the mere thought of mutiny, and Harry Pegler had never disagreed with either the rule or the punishment. Crozier walked over.
"Harry, do you feel well enough to go along with Lieutenant Little? I'd like you to handle the tiller. Mr. Reed and Lieutenant Little will be in the bow."
"Oh, yes, Captain. I feel fine."
Pegler was shocked that Captain Crozier thought he looked or acted sick.
"Have I been malingering in any way?"
The very thought that he could have been made him sicker.
"I need a good man on the sweep oar, and a third assessment as to whether this lead is a go," whispered Crozier. "And I need at least one man along who knows how to swim."
Pegler smiled at this, even as his scrotum tightened at the thought of going into that black, cold water. The air temperature was below freezing, and the water, with all its salt content, would be as well. Crozier clapped Pegler on the shoulder and moved on to talk to another volunteer. It was obvious to the foretop captain that Crozier was carefully picking the men he wanted along on this scouting trip, while keeping others, like First Mate DeVoe, Second Mate Robert Thomas,
bosun's mate and Terra's disciplinarian Tom Johnson, and all the Marines with him, and alert. In 30 minutes, they had the boat ready to float. It was a strangely equipped expedition within an expedition. They brought along a bag with some salt pork and biscuits, as well as some water bottles in case they became lost or otherwise extended the 4-hour mission. Each of the 9 men was handed an axe or pickaxe. If they should find a small berg overhanging and blocking the lead, or if a scrim of ice should block the way, they would try hacking their way through. Pegler knew that if a wider, thicker band of ice stopped them, they would portage the whaleboat to the next band of open water, if they could. He hoped that he had the strength left to do his part in lifting, pulling and shoving the heavy boat for 100 yards or more. Captain Crozier handed Lieutenant Little a 2-barreled shotgun and a bag of cartridges. The items were stowed in the bow. Should they somehow be stranded out there, Pegler knew, the heaps of supplies they kept on board included a double-sized tent and a tarp for the floor. There were 3 3-man sleeping bags kept in the boat, but they did not plan to get lost out there. The men crawled in and found their places as the ice fog curled around them. The previous winter, Crozier and the other officers and mates had discussed having Mr. Honey and Mr. Weeks, before his death on Erebus in March, raise the sides of all the boats. The small craft would have been better prepared for open seas that way. But in the end, it was decided to keep the gunwales at their usual height to better facilitate river travel. Also, to that end, Crozier had ordered all the oars cut down in length so that they might more easily be used as paddles on the river. The remaining ton or so of bundled food and gear in the bottom of the boat made seating difficult. Those 6 seamen at the oars had to prop their feet on the duffels and would be rowing or paddling with their knees as high as their heads, and as the man at the oar sweep tiller, Pegler found himself sitting on a rope-wrapped bundle rather than on the stern bench. But everyone fit, and there was room for Lieutenant Little and Mr. Reed to perch in the bow with their long pikes. The men were eager to launch the boat. There was a chorus of 1, 2, 3, and several heave-hoes, and the heavy whaleboat slid across the ice. The bow tipped and fell 2 feet into the black water. The oarsmen fended off nearby ice as Mr. Reed and Lieutenant Little crouched and grabbed the gunwales. The men on the ice heaved again, oars found water, and they were moving away in the fog. The first boat from Erebus or Terra to feel liquid water under its hull in almost 2 years and 11 months. A spontaneous cheer went up, followed by the more traditional 3 hip-hip hurrahs. Pegler steered the boat to the centre of the narrow lead, never more than 20 feet across here, sometimes barely room for the shortened oars to find water on both sides, and by the time he glanced back over his shoulder, all the men on the ice were lost in the fog astern. The next 2 hours were dreamlike. Pegler had steered a small boat through floe ice before. It had taken more than a week of poking into berg-ridden harbours and inlets before they'd found the right anchorage for the 2 ships at Beachy Island 2 autumns ago, and Pegler had been in command of one of those small boats for days, but that had not felt like this. The lead stayed narrow, never more than 30 feet wide, and sometimes so tight they propelled the whaleboat by poling on the ice that scraped the sides rather than by rowing. And the narrow channel of open water would bend left and then right, but never quite so tightly that the boat could not make the turns. Tumbles of pressure-raised ice hid the view to either side, and the fog continued to close on them, then open a bit, then close even more tightly. Sounds seemed to be muffled and amplified at the same time, and the effect was unsettling. Men found themselves whispering when they had to communicate. Twice they encountered stretches where floating ice blocked the way, or the lead itself was frozen over to the point that most of the men had to clamber out to shove floating ice ahead with pikes, or to hack away at the frozen surface with pickaxes. Some of the men stayed on the ice on either side then, pulling at ropes tied to the bow and thwarts, or grabbing the gunwales and shoving and pulling the screeching whaleboat through the narrow crevice. Each time, the lead then widened enough that the men could clamber back in and shove, paddle, and row their way forward. They had been creeping forward this way for almost their full allotment of 2 hours, when suddenly the meandering lead narrowed. Ice scraped both sides,
but they used the oars to pole as Pegler stood in the bow, his steering sweep useless. Then suddenly they popped out into what was by far the widest stretch of open water they had seen. As if confirming that all their troubles were behind them, the fog lifted so that they could see hundreds of yards. They had either reached true open water or a massive lake in the ice. Sunlight streamed down from a hole in the clouds above and turned the seawater blue. A few low, flat icebergs, one the size of a respectable cricket pitch, floated ahead of them in the azure sea. The icebergs prismed the light, and the weary men shielded their eyes from the painful glory of sunlight, shimmering on snow, ice, and water. The six men at the oars gave a loud, spontaneous cheer.
"Not yet, men," said Lieutenant Little.
He was peering through his brass telescope, his foot up on the whaleboat's bow.
"We don't know yet if this goes on, if there's a way out of this ice lake other than the way we came in. Let's make sure of that before we turn back."
"Oh, it goes on,"
shouted the seaman named Berry from his place at the oars.
"I feel it in my bones. It's open water and fair breezes between here and Back's River all right. We'll get the others, open our sails, and be there before supper tomorrow."
"I pray you're right, Alex," said Lieutenant Little. "But let's spend some time and sweat to make certain. I want to bring nothing but good news back to the rest of the men."
Mr. Reed, their ice master, pointed back at the lead from which they had emerged.
"There are a dozen inlets here. We might have trouble finding the real lead when we come back unless we mark it now. Men, bring us back to the opening there. Mr. Pegler, why don't you take that extra pike and drive it into the snow and ice there at the edge where we can't miss it on our way back? It'll give us something to row toward."
"Aye,"
said Pegler. With their return avenue marked, they rowed out into the open water. The large flat iceberg was only 100 yards or so from the opening to their inlet, and they rowed close to it on their way toward open water.
"We could camp on a ton and have plenty of room left over," said Henry Sate, one of the Terror seamen at the oars.
"We don't want to camp," said Lieutenant Little from the bow. "We've had enough camping for a fucking lifetime. We want to go home."
The men cheered and put their backs into it. Pegler at the sweep started a shanty, and the men sang along, the first real singing they'd done in months.
It took them 3 hours, a full hour beyond the time they should have turned back, but they had to be sure.
The open water was an illusion, a lake in the ice a little more than a mile and a half long, and a little more than 2/3 of a mile wide. Dozens of apparent leads opened from the irregular southern, eastern, and northern ice edges of the lake, but they were all false starts, mere inlets. At the southeastern terminus of the lake, they tied up to the ice shelf, driving a pickaxe into the 6-foot-thick ice and tying onto it, then cutting steps up the side as if it were a wharf. All the men clambered out and looked to the direction they'd hoped the open water continued. Solid, flat, white. Ice and snow and seracs. And the clouds were coming down again, swirling into a low fog. It was beginning to snow. After Lieutenant Little looked in each direction, they boosted the smallest man, Berry, up onto the shoulders of the largest man there,
36-year-old Billy Wentzall,
and let Berry look through the glass. He boxed the compass with his search, telling Wentzall when to turn.
"Not so much as a fucking penguin," he said.
It was an old joke, referring to Captain Crozier's trip to the other pole. No one laughed.
"Do you see dark sky anywhere?" asked Lieutenant Little. "As one sees over open water, or the tip of a larger berg?"
"Nay, sir, and the clouds is coming closer."
Little nodded. "Let's head back, boys. Harry, you clamber down into the boat first and steady her, will you?"
No one said a word in their 90-minute pull across the lake. The sunlight disappeared and the fog blotted away the landscape again, but before long the cricket pitch berg loomed out of the mist and showed them that they were going the correct direction.
"We're almost back to the lead," called Little from the bow.
At times the fog was so thick that Pegler in the stern had trouble seeing the lieutenant.
"Mr. Pegler, a little to port, please."
"Aye, sir."
The men at the oars did not even look up. To a man, they seemed lost in the misery of their thoughts.
Snow was pelting them again, but from the northwest now. At least the men at the oars had their backs to it. When the fog did lift a bit, they were less than 100 feet from the inlet.
I see the pike, Mr. Reed said tonelessly. A bit to starboard and you have it lined up nicely, Harry.
Something's wrong, said Pegler.
What do you mean?
Called back the lieutenant. Some of the seamen looked up from their oars and frowned at Pegler. With their backs to the bow, they could not see ahead.
Do you see that sarac, or big ice boulder near the pike I left at the mouth of the lead? Said Harry.
Yes, said Lieutenant Little. So?
It wasn't there when we came out, said Pegler.
Back oars,
ordered Little, uselessly, since the men had already ceased their rowing and were backstroking briskly, but the heavy whaleboat's momentum continued carrying it toward the ice. The ice boulder turned.